Thank you, Mo. Scott Grant here. I was not here with you last week, but I had a pretty good excuse because I was here. I was here. That is our daughter, Christina, and her husband, Garrett, and they got married last Sunday. And you can see me in the background there, just a little bit my head. I had the joy of not only being the father of the bride, but also the officiant. I held it together during the ceremony, but at the reception during my speech, I absolutely lost it. And one of the points I lost it was when I was some people say that it takes a village, but for Karen and me, it took a church. So thank you, PBC. So, yeah. All right, transitioning to this week. So my father had this raft that he bought, and he called it the Mexican Queen because the first place we used it was in Mexico. The second place we used it was on the McKelmey River in the foothills of the Sierra. And so he took my two brothers and me on this rafting trip on the river, and we were having a great time. We were young at that particular time. We're all 3 years apart, so I think we were probably 4 and 7 and 9, myself being the oldest. The first mile was absolutely great. And then the current of the McKelmey swept us toward the bank and toward this tree that was protruding from the bank and toward this particular branch, and this branch punctured a hole in the Mexican Queen. And the Mexican Queen was taking on water, and we were going down. So my father, having only two arms, used those two arms to corral my youngest brother, Bruce, age 4 approximately, as he cried out to the others of us, my other brother and me. He cried out, "Save yourselves, boys!" I did not know it. He didn't know it at the time, and I didn't really know it until I started studying the passage we're looking at today. But what my father was doing was he was echoing the words of Jesus. And Jesus instructs us in our passage today to save ourselves, not from physical peril, but from spiritual peril. And how do we do it? The way is counterintuitive. It's paradoxical, and it is also revolutionary. In our text today, Jesus teaches about his mission and our mission as well. An absolutely key text on what it means to follow Jesus. So let's look at it this morning. Following Jesus. Luke chapter 9, beginning at verse 18. Now it happened that as he was praying alone, emerging from this prayer, the disciples were with him, and he asked them, "Who do the crowds say that I am?" And they answered, "John the Baptist, but others say Elijah, and others that one of the prophets of old has risen." And then he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered, "The Christ of God." Peter, of course, being one of Jesus' disciples. Well, who do the crowds say that I am? Well, they say that he's some kind of a prophet. And what about the question today? Who do you say that Jesus is? And of course, you can hardly avoid the question. Most people in the world are familiar with Jesus, and they have some sort of opinion on who Jesus is. And many would answer in a similar vein. He's a prophet, or he was a good teacher. He had good advice. But a prophet, a good teacher, poses little threat to the status quo. Now, Peter has this other answer. You are the Christ of God. Christ meaning Messiah, the Jewish Messiah who is expected. The prophets especially began to conceive of and understand that there was this one individual who was going to come in the future, this one particular Israelite, and he was going to be the Christ, the King, the ultimate King. And the vision for this Jewish King was he was going to be triumphant, and he was going to rule the whole world. And so Peter says, "Okay, I believe it. You are the Christ of God." Great news, right? And now finally the disciples seem to be catching on to this. We've already seen earlier in the Gospel of Luke that Luke has identified Jesus as the Christ, and now one of his disciples picks up on it. Great news, right? Go tell it on the mountain, tell everyone, right? Not exactly. Verse 21, And he strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, the Son of Man, that's his preferred title for himself, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, these would be among the Jewish leaders, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. So why doesn't Jesus want his disciples to tell everyone that he's the Christ? Well, if you went around telling people that this particular individual was the Christ, the Jewish king, then the watchful eye of Rome might take notice, and Caesar and his people didn't take too kindly to other kings. And so, and in addition to that, they have the completely wrong idea of what it means to be the Christ, so that Jesus needs to buy time for himself to instruct his disciples on what it actually means to be the Christ and what it means to follow the Christ. So for now, make sure you don't tell anyone, because you have the completely wrong idea, and Jesus isn't ready to die yet. He needs to buy time for himself. You see, the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, was expected to fight Israel's battles for them. But Jesus says it's really not going to be like what you expect at all. And you take these particular Jewish leaders. He would be expected, if he were the Messiah, to defeat them or win them over. And instead, it's not going to happen that way. They're going to reject him. And ultimately, Jesus says he's going to be killed. Well, this doesn't seem to make sense to the disciples. We know that because as we move forward in the Gospel of Luke, it's clear that they don't understand what he's talking about. And then Jesus says he's going to be raised on the third day. They don't understand that either. There was this understanding that there was going to be a resurrection of the dead all at once at the end of the story, but not in the middle. After only 3 days, you're going to rise from the dead. They just don't comprehend it. So Jesus is going to have to drive it into their minds and their hearts again and again, eventually to the point where they do get it after the resurrection and after the coming of the Spirit. So they don't understand because they have a particular way of looking at things. What Paul Simon sang years ago rings all too true even today. A man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. It's true, isn't it? So what does it mean that Jesus is the Christ? Taking into account the entire biblical story, it means he is the risen Lord of the world, and he is reigning, he's ruling right now from heaven over earth. What does that mean? Well, that means that everyone is subject to him. He really is going to mess with the status quo. He's messing with it right now, and he's going to mess with it, of course, later, because everyone is going to have to submit to him. So when you say that Jesus is the Christ, what does that mean? He's Lord. What does that mean? You have to submit to him. But let's think about this for a little bit. If we believe that Jesus is the Christ, if Jesus is Lord, if he's Lord of the world, if he's Lord of my life, perhaps I have a few expectations of what that's supposed to look like. Perhaps I have some expectations about how Jesus, as the Christ, as Lord, is going to serve my purposes, maybe advance things for me and defeat and trounce my enemies and advance things for me and my people, and it's supposed to look like this. Perhaps we have some sort of vision of what it means for Jesus to be the Christ, particularly for what it means for Jesus to be the Christ in our lives, in our world today. Well, Jesus had to instruct his disciples, and he has to instruct us. Yes, Jesus is the Christ. What does it mean to follow the Christ? Verse 23, here's our key verse. And he said to all, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. To come after Jesus and to follow Jesus are two ways of saying the same thing. So if you want to come after Jesus and if you want to follow Jesus, what does that mean? It means that you deny yourself and you take up your cross and you do so daily. So let's think about this. What does it mean to deny yourself? You probably have some sort of vision of what you would like your life to be. And to deny yourself, you give up your right to define your vision for your life and you give it to someone else, namely Jesus. And why do you do that? Well, obviously Jesus commands us to do so, but you have to do that really because you have to understand that he is more trustworthy to define your life than you are. You don't know the future. You don't know yourself nearly as well as Jesus does. You don't know how he's made you the way he's made you nearly as well as he does and what his purposes are for you and what the future is. And so you deny yourself. You give up your vision to define your life and you give that vision to Jesus. And then what do? You take up your cross. So what does this mean? Let's think about this in the context of Israel at this particular time. Now, if you had the Messiah coming along, and you had the Messiah coming along, and you were a Jewish nationalist, what would you want the Messiah to do? Lead you in rebellion against Rome. Not everyone wanted that, but a lot of people wanted that. And so what would you take up to follow the Messiah? You would take up a sword. And that's exactly what Peter later took up in the Garden of Gethsemane. He took up a sword. He's gonna fight for Jesus. And what does Jesus say? Put away the sword. You put away the sword. So first of all, to take up your cross means to put away the sword. You put away anger and you put away hatred and you put away revenge. You put away all these kinds of things. And what's Jesus doing? Because Jesus is after a bigger foe than the Romans. And you don't take on the Romans by taking up a sword. You take on the Romans by putting on love. And Jesus is, what is he doing? He's going beyond the Romans to take on Satan himself. That's the big foe. He's going after Satan. In order to take on Satan, you put on love. What does Satan want you to do? Return evil for evil and all of that. And that's how evil stays in circulation. You take up a sword against me, I take up a sword against you. You punch me, I punch you. You hate me, I hate you. And that's how the world works, but that's not how it works in the church, or that's not how it's supposed to work in the church because of what Jesus teaches and models. So what say ye? Is he the Christ or isn't he the Christ? Am I going to follow him or not? I don't take up a sword. Instead, I put on love. What does that mean? We've already heard what it means in the Gospel of Luke. Back to the Sermon on the Plain. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. Offer the other cheek. As you wish that others would do to you, do so for them. And here, take up your cross. Not easy. And Jesus doesn't expect it to be easy. What do you do when all this stuff is aimed against you? Maybe you're hated. Maybe you're rejected. Maybe people take up swords and take up anger against you. What do you want to do? You want to return it, don't you? And how do you avoid doing that? One of the great biblical secrets is the secret of lament. In the Psalms, we are given these Psalms of lament in which the psalmists pour out their hearts to God. They tell God exactly how they're feeling about all of this. That yes, they want to fight back. And they pour out their hearts, how they really feel. But by the end of the psalm, in these Psalms of lament, usually they are in a different place. And by the way, Jesus lamented. Where did he lament? When he was on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Right out of Psalm 22, David's great lament. And so here, and only in the Gospel of Luke, do we get this word daily. Take up your cross daily. So what does that mean? There are these huge, big decisions in life in which we're going to have to take up our cross in self-sacrificial love. But if we do this daily, this means there are small, little decisions that come to us all the time. We have the opportunity to practice self-giving love on a daily basis. And when you do this, when you practice self-giving love in these small little ways on a daily basis, that sets a pattern for your life so that you're ready when the big decision comes to really to take up that big cross and follow Jesus, you'll be ready for it. Think about Jesus. So he made constant decisions. We can see that in the Gospel of Luke all the time for the sake of love. He did not appear out of nowhere in the Garden of Gethsemane to make the most important and the most difficult decision that has ever been made. The decision to actually stay in Gethsemane and wait for those who were coming to put him on trial and ultimately to crucify him. He was ready for Gethsemane. He didn't appear out of nowhere to make that decision. So what does it mean for us to take up our crosses? Enter places of pain. Enter places of pain. We think about the cross, the cross that Jesus hung on. What's going on there? He's taken on the sins of the world. He's taking on the pain of the world, and he's absorbing all of that. And so when Jesus tells us to take up our cross and follow him, what do? We enter places of pain where people are hurting and suffering, where sin has taken over their lives, and or where depression is overwhelming them, or where they can't find a meal to eat. We enter places of pain. And when you do that, you open yourself up to rejection. All right? You move forward into places of pain, and oftentimes you're rejected. I've wondered to myself if I had received all of the validation and the affirmation and the acceptance that I have wanted and didn't get, where would I be today? As it was, I've suffered some rejection in my life, which has taken me to a deeper place with Jesus and enabled me, at least to some degree, to identify with the pain of others. So rejection can be a great gift. It can escort you into the presence of Jesus. Now, some people think that when they take up a cross and follow Jesus and maybe enter places of pain, that what they are supposed to be doing is to take on the expectations of others. Other people want me to do this, therefore I'm going to do this, therefore Jesus wants me to do this because people expect me to do this. Well, you're not taking on your cross, you're taking on expectations. You're taking on maybe somebody else's cross, but not your own cross. And by the way, if you look at the life of Jesus, does he look like the kind of person who just always gave in to expectations? No, of course not. We can look earlier in the Gospel of Luke and see that he healed people in a particular town, and the people in that town wanted him to stay, no doubt for more healings. And what does Jesus say? Time to go someplace else. I'm leaving these people, these hurting people right here, and it's time for me to go someplace else. He was following the Lord. He was taking his cues from the Spirit, not from the expectations around him. And some people think, oh, well, if I enter places of pain and take up my cross, that means I'm an enabler. I enable other people's sin. Well, does Jesus strike you as a doormat? He had no problem standing up to people. He had no problem telling people the absolute truth. No, you don't become an enabler. But you pay attention to the Lord, and you pay attention to the scriptures, and you pay attention to prayer. You don't do everything, but as the Spirit leads, you do something. The way is counterintuitive. It's paradoxical. It's also revolutionary. When I first came across this quote from N.T. Wright, I was very moved by it. It's somewhat long. I've actually edited it for you somewhat, but let me just read it for you. Jesus commissions us then to follow him to where the hungry sit on the ground with distended stomachs, to where the dispossessed lie on the ground, past anger and past hope, to where the old people are forgotten and the young people are brutalized. Follow me, he says, to the bright lights of the city and the sad darkness of the depopulated countryside, to the corridors of power and the alleyways of despair, to the married people who have forgotten how to love and the unmarried people who long for the chance to learn how, to the businessman and the prostitute. Follow me and get this. Follow me and tell them that I love them. Tell them that I died for them. Tell them that I am alive for them. Tell them that there is a new creation. Tell them that there is a new celebration. Tell them that there is a God who made them and yearns for them, and that if they find me, they will find him. So Frederick Buechner is a writer, or was a writer, and he tells a story of one time when he was visiting his mother in her apartment. He was in her his 20s, and he received a phone call from a friend who was in tears, who had just heard that his parents and his pregnant sister had been in an automobile accident, and that it was uncertain whether any of them would live. So this friend was at the airport, called Buechner from the airport. The friend was at the airport waiting for a flight to take him to them, his family, and asked Buechner, then in his 20s, to come and wait with him until the plane left. So the phone call comes to Frederick Buechner, and the friend asks, will you just come to the airport and wait with me until the plane leaves? And Buechner, reflecting on this episode, says this: I was afraid of my friend's fear and of his tears. I was afraid of his faith that I could somehow be a comfort and help to him, and afraid that I was not friend enough to be able to be. He didn't want to go because he was afraid. He didn't want to enter that place of pain because he was afraid he would not be able to live up to the expectations of his friend. Now, courage is not absence of fear. Courage is doing something you're afraid of. So yeah, sure, you're afraid. I'm afraid. I'm afraid to enter those places of pain. I'm afraid I don't have all the answers. I'm afraid I don't know what to do. I'm afraid I'm going to be trapped somehow. Yeah, I'm afraid. But courage is moving forward despite the fear. Now, Jesus tells us to take up our cross, but he also gives us a very powerful reason for doing so. Verses 24 through 27. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But I tell you, truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God. So what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits himself? So think about things from the perspective back then of a Jewish nationalist. What did they want to gain? They wanted to gain the land of Israel. They wanted to kick out the Romans and gain the land of Israel. And Jesus says, well, if you do that, not only that, but if your wildest dreams were successful so that you attained the whole world, not just the land of Israel, but the whole world, that's not worth it because you're losing yourself. You're sacrificing who you are. Nothing would compensate for that kind of loss. And of course, what did the devil offer Jesus? We've seen that in the Gospel of Luke. He offered him the kingdoms of the world. You've got to bow down and worship me. The kingdoms of the world. And Jesus refused. Of course, that's what God would grant him, the kingdoms of the world, but only after he took up his own cross. Why should we then take up our cross and enter places of pain? Well, first, because of what you lose if you don't. Because what you lose is yourself. What you lose is your life. What you lose is your humanity, because this is actually the way to live. The way to live is to take up your cross and enter places of pain. And Jesus has a warning for those who refuse to do so, for those who refuse to follow him. He says, hey, when I come, you know, if you want nothing to do with Jesus, when he comes, then he's going to want nothing to do with you, because it's all your choice. He leaves it up to you. Freedom of choice. You can follow him or not follow him. How are you going to even want to see Jesus if you haven't followed him? And yeah, of course, Jesus, if you don't want him, he's not going to want you. It's very simple. So more powerfully, however, is the incentive to save your life. You take up your cross, you follow Jesus, you enter places of pain, and you save your life. What does this mean? Here's what I think it means. You realize your humanity. This is who you're supposed to be. This is who God made you to be. And if you search your heart, if you're a follower of Jesus, you'll find it in your heart. This is what you want to do. You want to give your life to some beautiful cause for the sake of Jesus. To love, to give your life away, to find the cause that is really worth dying for if you must. And that cause, of course, is Jesus. And Jesus tells us to love people, enter places of pain, love people. This is who you are. You become surely and eventually what deep down you want to be. And what happens as we do this? What happens as we take up our crosses and follow Jesus? What did he do? He, of course, took up his cross. What happened on the cross? This is a victory. This represents a defeat of evil, the triumph over evil. Jesus stays on the cross. He's resurrected. What are we doing then when we take up our crosses? It's an implementation of the victory of God over evil. Again, what does evil want? Evil wants you to strike back, evil for evil. What does God want? God wants you to take on that evil and move forward with love. And that's how we implement the victory of God, the victory of the cross. So what do? We enter places of pain to realize our humanity. So remember Frederick Buechner? He was afraid. He didn't want to go to the airport. Here's what happened. My mother's apartment by candlelight was haven and home and shelter from everything in the world that seemed dangerous and a threat to my peace. And my friend's broken voice on the phone was a voice calling me out into that dangerous world, not simply for his sake as I suddenly saw it, but also for my sake. The shattering revelation of that moment was that true peace, the peace that passeth all understanding, is to be had not in retreat from the battle, but only in the thick of the battle. And here's what he says. To journey for the sake of saving our own lives is little by little to cease to live in any sense that really matters, even to ourselves, because it is only by journeying for the world's sake, even when the world bores and sickens and scares you half to death, that little by little we start to come alive. It was not a conclusion that I came to in time. It was a conclusion from beyond time that came to me. God knows I have never been any good at following the road it pointed me to, but at least by grace, I glimpsed the road and saw that it is the only one worth traveling. Jesus calls us to take up our crosses, not least for our own sake, because this is the way to live. And deep down, you know it. Joe Klein is a political pundit, and several years ago, he was writing a story for a Time magazine, and he was going about visiting different parts of the country and interviewing people, specifically on their political views. And he came to this place in Newcomerstown, Ohio, and he came to a place called the Journeys End Ministries Food Pantry, which was run by 30 different churches who were supplying volunteers for this food pantry in Ohio. And secular pundit makes this observation: the needy people found something at Journey's End that they couldn't find at government agencies, a loving community that wasn't judgmental. Is that what we are? Is that what we can be? A loving community that is not judgmental. And then he interviewed the director of the food pantry, a woman by the name of Janet Gore. And Janet said this: the daily joys that she felt in the food pantry were so great and so overwhelming that they overwhelmed everything else. Now listen to this quote. So she's lecturing, sort of. She's preaching almost to the secular pundit. And she says this to him: you can just feel how happy we are, how blessed we are to do this work, can't you? And you know how Joe Klein finished his column? Yes, I could. He could feel it. He could see it. He could see the love of Christ. He could see people taking up their crosses and entering places of pain and bringing love. Can you just feel how blessed we are to take up our crosses, to love, to enter places of pain? And right here, I'm going to channel Ron Ritchie, one of our old pastors. Some of you old timers will recognize and remember Ron. I overlapped with Ron for about a year here. And Ron would often say, toward the end of his sermons, he would say something like this: why would you want to live any other way? Indeed, here it is laid out for us. Why would you want to live any other way? My father cried out, save yourselves, boys, when the Mexican Queen was going down. He had my brother Bruce around his arms, and my brother Glenn and I, we managed to grab hold of this branch, and we shimmied ourselves to shore, and we saved ourselves. All three brothers, now in our 60s, are alive today. All three brothers were at this wedding last Sunday, and so here we are alive today. We saved ourselves. How do you save yourself from spiritual peril? You grab hold of the branch. Jeremiah the prophet called the Messiah the righteous branch. You grab hold of the branch. Then what? Then you take up your cross and follow Jesus. You enter places of pain to realize your humanity. It is counterintuitive. It is paradoxical. It is also revolutionary. It is how the kingdom comes. You have an assignment. Every once in a while, I give you an assignment. You have an assignment this week. It's a very easy one. It's not a big one. It's a small one. Think of something you can do this week for the sake of love that costs you something, even if it only costs you 5 minutes. It could be with people you live with. It could be with a neighbor. Just think of something you can do for the sake of love that costs you something, even if it only costs you 5 minutes.